was inherited by a small band of network commentators and self-appointed analysts. Perhaps the place to start looking for a credibility gap is not in the offices of the government in Washington, but in the studios of the networks in New York.
Agnew's rhetoric has found a strong ally in the Justice Department. In 1969, for example, four Chicago newspapers, Time Magazine, Life Magazine, Newsweek, and NBC News, were all served with subpoenas for unedited material on radical left activities in Chicago. In 1970, CBS TV was served with a subpoena to produce every piece of material involved in the filming of a program about the Black Panthers, including tapes not edited or televised. Such intimidating actions, which have become the rule rather than the exception, have already adversely affected some of the largest and most important of our news-gathering institutions. John V. Oakes, editorial page editor of the Times, has admitted that Agnew's speeches have caused a toning down of the quality of the Times' dissent. And because of Agnew's complaint that the media present only bad news, the ABC network has appointed a so-called happy news producer, whose function it is to see the potentially disturbing stories about napalmed human beings, for example, are balanced with something more pleasant, something which will, presumably, provide a fairy tale happy ending to that nasty old news broadcast.
On June 29, 1972, in a decision which received remarkably limited attention from the media whose very life it threatened, the judicial arm of the government joined in the attack on the freedom of the press. In one of its classic 5-4 decisions, the Nixonized Supreme Court held that journalists have no First Amendment right to refuse to tell grand juries the names of confidential sources and information. The case in question was that of Earl Caldwell, a Black reporter for the Times who in 1970 had been served with a federal grand jury subpoena ordering him to turn over confidential material he had gathered in connection with the story on the Black Panther Party. He refused, and the Times, its liberal conscience tweaked, supported him against the subsequent prosecution by the Department of Justice. In previous cases of this nature, lower courts had usually held that the First Amendment shields newsmen from having to testify when the effect would be to cut off news sources and deprive the public of news. The High Court's unprecedented reversal of that practice was a landmark decision, a contemporary reenactment of the Zenger trial. Only this time, the principle of freedom of the press was not affirmed, but firmly squelched. From then on, a newsman risked imprisonment for himself or his sources every time he published or broadcast confidential material. The effect of the court's decision in the Caldwell case could only be to prevent controversial material from coming before the scrutiny of the public, or alternatively, to turn the most effective and sensitive journalists into government spies.
Already the effects of the Caldwell decision are being felt. Early in October, Peter Bridge, a reporter for the Newark Evening News, was jailed indefinitely for refusing to answer grand jury questions about a story he wrote exposing corruption in the Newark Housing Authority. Although he had named his source of information in the story, the grand jury wanted to know if he had been told anything more. Bridge refused to betray what had been imparted to him in confidence, and was thus imprisoned for declining to answer questions about facts he had not published and to which he might not even know the answers. The Supreme Court has not yet heard the case, but its attitude was not encouraging when it refused to delay Bridges' sentence until it could make a ruling.
Has a man gone around taking names? Has a man gone around taking names?
Over the summer of 1972, the government opened its case against Dan Ellsberg and Tony Rousseau, who a year earlier had had the courage to place before the American people the now infamous Pentagon Papers. In pre-trial maneuvering, the government revealed its hostility to the principles of a free and open press in various ways. The prosecution asked the court to take steps to ensure that the trial was not influenced by what it called the heavily biased and misleading picture presented by the media's portrayal of the defendants as champions of a free press and a public and congressional right to know. To counter this so-called bias, the prosecution suggested the following questions be asked of prospective jurors. Do you subscribe to or regularly read the New York Times, the Washington Post, Saturday Review, Atlantic Monthly, Harper's, or Ramparts? Apparently, according to the government, anyone who is likely to ever read the free press is incapable of deciding if and when the free press is being jeopardized.
Yet perhaps nothing is more indicative of the government's callous attitude toward basic civil liberties than the revelation of July 21st, which spun the trial into one of the longest delays in judicial history.